This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our virtual Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show talking with Tucker Lucas. He is an ensemble member of Theater B, which is located in Moorhead, but is Fargo-Moorhead's professional theater, if you will. And he is the director of the upcoming play that's just about to open, The Majority. And Tucker, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Doug.
Tell us about the play. Why The Majority?
Well, okay, so, you know, 2020 is a pretty crazy year, right? And we're all dealing with this pandemic going on. And at Theater B, we were going, what's a way we could produce theater in as safe a way as possible? And we thought, well, you know, you have as few people in the room as possible. And to do that, you have a one-person show. So we were looking for something that we could do that was not only, you know, as COVID safe as we could make it, but also actually had something to do with the times we're in right now. And someone connected to our company found this play and handed it to us, and we read it and we said, we got to do it. We got to do this show because it's about the fairness / unfairness of elections and what it's like to be the winners and the losers in elections. And we also knew that the script was one that we could do as a live stream on the internet. So part of our COVID safety reasoning was that, hey, listen, you know, if we can only have a few people in the room of the cast itself, you know, there's a chance we'll never even be able to have a live audience in the room. You know, we're still waiting to see on that. You know, we follow the state of Minnesota's guidelines on how to do that. But because of that, we designed the show to be catered to a streaming audience. So the vast majority of our audience is going to be people sitting in the safety and comfort of their homes, watching from home. We've designed the show for them. And then because we have this thing in the show that's interactive where you can actually vote using any internet enabled device with a web browser like a computer or a phone, the audience will actually be able to interact with the show as they watch it.
Wow. So they will affect the outcome of the show?
There's a section towards the end where, yeah, you have a direct impact on exactly what happens in the show. A lot of the questions are polling the audience's opinion to find out if you agree or disagree with certain propositions that get put forth. But you actually have an effect, Doug, on whether or not you get to have a bathroom break, believe it or not.
Well, my hand's already raised. Well, the blurb from Theater B about The Majority, which is by playwright Rob Drummond, is that it's a smart, funny reflection on the imperatives and imperfections of democracy. The principles sound great, but they're so messy in practice. And so this particular play by Rob Drummond, I did a little bit of research here, was written about the time that the Scottish independence referendum was going on back in 2014. So he was interested in that political debate and discussion. Is the play as written? Does it have that component of how the audience can affect the outcome?
Yeah. That was his part of what he was doing at the very beginning. It's to the core of the message of the play itself. Because the play does not focus specifically on any particular political ideology, it's not trying to target any particular group. It's not trying to make any particular statement about any particular topic. It's really more of a reflection on political culture itself and how when we get caught in the throes of it, how if we're not careful, things can become pretty toxic. So yeah, it's set against the backdrop. It starts in 2014, right after that, the Scottish independence referendum happened. And it actually spans the time through to 2016 in the election of Donald Trump. So it covers a period of time where you follow our lead character, Robbie Drummond, played by Claire Lynch, another ensemble member of the company, as she kind of starts the play. She's not apolitical. It's not a play about, hey, aren't politics gross and dumb? She's someone who is definitely unactivated, so to speak, uninvolved. And she is tasked with writing a play about that Scottish vote referendum and along the way meets some really, really interesting characters that take her down a pretty interesting path.
So this is a one-person show.
Yep.
And how are the other characters presented?
So that's one of my favorite things about one person shows is that not only do all the sets almost and every setting and every place and every feeling comes from the actor. Every character comes from the actor too. And Claire does a fantastic job. I think, I can't remember the exact number. I'd estimate she probably plays roughly 10 characters in the show, including the lead. And because it's a play that's set in Europe, it's set in Scotland. So typically, if you were to see it, originally performed, it would be in a Scottish accent. But what we opted to do is instead is we reserve accents, Scottish and British, for when she's playing other characters. And then when she's playing just herself, she's speaking in her northern Midwestern accent. And then she does some other body work too, and does a pretty good job of it.
Now, the show, The Majority, is running October 30th through November 14th. So it's around the election, arguably one of the biggest, most talked about elections in my lifetime. But this is a shorter run than usual for Theater B. Why?
It's anytime you're deciding the length of a run, there's all sorts of factors that go into it. When we do longer runs, which are, a typical Theater B show is either 4 weekends or 5 weekends. And one of the pieces of that calculus is that you can only fit so many people in a room. Right. So we can only if physically in our space, I think we seat a little over 100. So we're really limited as to how many audience members we can even give an opportunity to come see the show. So we have to add more performances to give more people opportunities. In this scenario, because we're streaming, we're not really limited by that space of it. We also didn't want to do anything less than three because, Doug, this. Obviously a show is ready when it opens, but shows morph and change during their run as well. And we didn't want to just do one weekend and not let the show breathe and change over time. And not only that, but be influenced by the election. I mean, we open this upcoming weekend and the election is happening right after that. So that's one of the things that enticed us about doing this play at this time was that we are it's sort of a wait and see of how is the audience going to take this show before the election versus after the election. And there's so many different ways that that could shake out. It's kind of this fun experiment that we're doing.
Tucker Lucas is the director of The Majority. He's an ensemble member at Theater B. Some theaters are basically recording theatrical presentations and then streaming them online. You are actually going to live stream this. Why that?
For starters, my background outside of theater is in video and film production. I've been working in video production for at least 15 years. And when we knew we wanted to stream it, and when I was privileged with the task of directing the show, I thought, well, I'm going to use that background and I'm not just going to, let's not do this. I mean, earlier this year, when we all first locked down, Theater B did a series of Zoom performances that were awesome and a lot of fun. But I wanted to do something that was different than that. We also wanted to preserve as much of the theatrical experience as possible, right? And that's live. And so we opted to do something that's live just because that is part of what it is to be part of a live theater experience. Every performance is going to be different. And then on top of that, it's everything is different with every rights holder of every piece. And because we're now in this era of COVID where more theaters are looking to do stuff online, I think everyone is work figuring out, how do things like that work now that we're dealing with streaming audiences where you could have people all over the world tuning in and there's rules about recordings and stuff like that, so we gotta be cognizant of that too. So in that direction, then we really aim to design a show that sort of straddles the middle of what it is to be a play and what it is to be a TV show, right? So it's primarily a one camera show that's moving about on a track. It's not like a multi-camera setup that's all fancy schmancy and we're cutting between stuff. And it's also not just like a Zoom call. It's not Claire in front of a MacBook Pro. And so I think we were able to figure out something that was sort of a mesh between the two. So when you watch the show, yeah, you're sitting at home instead of in the theater and you're watching it on the internet, but you're going to get the feeling of watching live theater because that's exactly what's going on.
Usually a director is, there for rehearsals and then there for moral support when the curtain goes up. But are you actually working the show then?
Yep, I'm the camera operator. So all the camera moves you see going on, that's me doing that. That was another thing when we were going, what do we need to do to make our production as COVID safe as possible? That means as few people in the room as possible. And that means a lot of people are wearing multiple hats. So our crew has been pretty small, but they've been absolutely awesome. I should give them a shout out real quick if I can. Doug, Jake Hartsey's our assistant director. Leah Vogel's our stage manager. Obviously, I said Claire Lynch is our performer. David Hubner is our streaming engineer. Brian Lynch is our set designer. And then I've been handling a lot of just the video production aspects of it. So we've been able to keep it not even a skeleton crew, more of a bone marrow crew.
We're talking about The Majority, which will open soon at Theater B. It opens on October 30th, runs through November 14th. You can find out about tickets at theaterb.org. That is important because, Tucker, you mentioned you're streaming this live, which means that people buy tickets for a particular evening.
Correct. Yeah. So you get a ticket, and then I believe I'll have to check in, but I believe the procedure is you get an email with a specific link that day, and that's the link that you tune into. And then you can use any internet-enabled device that has a web browser like Chrome or Firefox or Safari. So you can then go to theaterb.org/vote, and you'll be able to vote on all the propositions that happen during the show.
Typically, there are accommodations for an audience. You have some sort of a set and lighting scheme. How about for this show?
We've got a full set. Brian Lynch, our set designer, did a phenomenal job. And it's got a green screen built into the center of it. So we're actually doing, if you typical watch the weather and you're wondering, how's that weather person getting the background they've got? Well, they're standing in front of a green screen, which they're keying out, and we're doing the same thing. And so we're throwing all sorts of graphics up. As we go forward, Doug, and as we continue to review just the landscape of COVID and whether or not the guidelines in Minnesota allow us to have a live audience, in the event that we can have a live audience that comes in, obviously everyone would have to be socially distanced, we'd be masked up, and we'd be following protocols. But if you were someone who had the opportunity to do that, you would also be getting a different experience than what the people streaming at home are getting. I liken it to like almost like attending a taping of The Late Show or something, where you're seeing all the production people, you're seeing the green screen, you're seeing the buttons being pushed and everything else going on. So, you know, if that opportunity arises, we'll let people know about it. It's gonna be pretty cool.
Let's talk about Theater B's pandemic season, because this has been disruptive to every live performance venue, Theater B included. You're programming in spite of COVID-19. What is the ensemble talking about now? What's next? How do you plan ahead when you don't have a vaccine yet? We have social distancing, people are wearing masks, etc.
At B, we always have a number of projects, sort of on the back burner that we're figuring out when we can kick them off. We had to, when COVID hit in March, we had to cancel the last show of our last season, The Father, which was going to be a fantastic, fantastic show. And then our plans for this season got, totally thrown out the window as well. So really what we do is we just go, listen, we don't know how long this is going to be going on for, but we know it's not forever. And, honestly, producing theater is a inherently optimistic venture, and so you really do have to have optimism when you go into it. So the art that we want to make, we're going to continue to look for ways to make it. And so part of doing The Majority is, hey, let's see how this works, right? Let's see what it's like for us. And we've never done a show like this before, ever, nothing even close to it. So if we can have some success with this, and if we can learn some really cool lessons from this, this could help us produce more art like this while we're all locked down. But in the meantime, we love live theater. We love in-person theater. So we're just looking forward to the day when we can all get back together and start to produce that art together again. In the meantime, we'll bide our time and stay connected, talk to each other, show each other love and support, and talk about the art we want to make.
And because you will be live streaming this production of The Majority, it's not limited to people who can drive to the theater. It anybody anywhere can buy a ticket and watch it.
We love that about that. That's something that's we've never really dealt with before. So looking forward to see what the audience thinks.
When you were looking at The Majority, were you looking at rights to stream? Did you have to negotiate that with them? And is that the kind of process you'll be going through for, the foreseeable future as we work our way through a pandemic?
This is what everyone's doing right now, right? Is we're still waiting on this election. We're waiting on vaccines for a pandemic, so much of it is wait and see. So we basically have plans A through E that we could probably fall back on depending on which scenario, but it's really tough to tell which scenario is going to be playing out anytime soon. When it comes to rights, yeah, I mean, that's Rob Drummond and his agency, they've been really great to work with. They were really cool with us at the outset. We got permission to stream and had to negotiate that into the rights. And that is probably going to become more of a standard thing now going forward, right? In a post-COVID world where more organizations may opt to do things like this more often, depending on the reasoning. So it's still new territory. I think everyone's still figuring it out. And it's actually really cool to be a part of that, you know?
You suggested that online may persist after the pandemic as another way to get it out there.
No matter what, there's going to be more streaming in general being implemented into how organizations, especially theaters, produce their content. And that could really be an economic choice, Doug, as we go forward, too, because, you know, you've been in the theater for a very long time. You know this as well as I do. If you want to make a lot of money, don't start a theater. You know, like that's not, and one of the reasons why that is because you are just limited to how many people you can actually bring into the room with you, right? You can't really, there's only so much you can do to reach a larger mass audience. So it's possible. Nonprofit theaters, which we are one, we've all always struggled to keep the lights on. It's just something that, it's because we're passionate about this thing that we do that we keep doing it. So I could absolutely see organizations going forward adopting things like this if it proves that it's a viable means of reaching a larger audience. So I guess we'll see.
The show is opening Friday. It runs for two weekends. It's called The Majority. It's by Rob Drummond. And we've been talking with the director. That's Tucker Lucas. Tucker, all the best. And Holzenbeinbruch, I guess, which is the German way of saying break your leg in your neck, which is good luck on the theater.
Thanks, Doug, and I'll see you soon.
All right. Coming up on Main Street, we'll remember Marilyn Hudson.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Marilyn Cross Hudson passed away last Thursday. For many years, she served as the historian for the three affiliated tribes. Before that, she spent more than 30 years working for the federal government, including a stint as an administrator for the Bureau of Indian Affairs for the Fort Berthold Agency. Today, we'll remember Marilyn Hudson with a clip from 2012, when Merrill Pepcorn visited her tribal museum and she shared some history.
The three affiliated tribes are the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and the Rikara, and the reason they say the MHA Nation is in order of their arrival on this land where we are today. The Mandan here first, probably the 1400s, maybe as early as the 1200s, then the Hidatsa, and then the Arikara, you know, later. But nonetheless, they've been allied for, you know, a century maybe along the Missouri River, which is the traditional and indigenous home of the three tribes.
How did they become affiliated?
Well, the Mandan and the Hidatsa have always had a close association. They've always been what we call allies as far back as they became acquainted. So, as you know, on the prairies, they had tribes had enemies and they had allies. And, of course, the Mandan and the Hidatsa were allies, always lived in close proximity to each other, shared buffalo hunts, worked together, shared an agricultural background. The Rikara at that time were farther downstream, down in Nebraska, South Dakota. And in the mid-1800s, late 1800s, when the Sioux began to expand and need more territory, they pushed the Rikara out of some of their original grounds. And so the Rikara moved north and eventually came into the upper Missouri, and the three tribes then just got together for mutual defense against the Sioux. And we've been together ever since the turn of the century, you know, the late 1800s and up through today. In today's present scene, we're one government. We have one constitution. We're known as the three affiliated tribes. And we conduct everything as one people, even though we are still three distinct tribes.
How did you become interested in history?
Well, I became interested in the museum, which, of course, is a history type of museum because it commemorates, you know, the heritage and the history of the three affiliated tribes. After I retired from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1992, I began as a volunteer helping out, and I became just totally enchanted, you know, with the history of the three tribes and the volume of materials that's available out there to learn about the three tribes, as well as doing some practical work. I found that there was a lot of interest in the history of our tribe, particularly during the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. And by the way, the Mandan and the Hidatsa, of course, were the tribes with whom the expedition spent that first very cold, what is now North Dakota, winter. So our tribes played a very big role in the celebration or the commemoration of that bicentennial.
What is it that you would like non-native people to know about the three affiliated tribes that they might not know?
I think one of the things people don't know is they picture all Plains Indians as a homogeneous group, you know, all on horseback chasing buffalo and fighting. But the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and Rikwa were agricultural. We stayed in one place. We lived in large villages. We had forms of government. We were self-sufficient to the extent that, you know, we raised enough vegetables and produce to supply other tribes. So I think that's one thing people don't understand about the three affiliated tribes, plus the fact that we're still pretty much basically in the same land base that we were 200 years ago.
Were you one of these kids who sat around at the feet of your parents and grandparents listening to their stories?
Well, not so much. I think what I recall is mostly work, hard work. I mean, with a garden and stuff. I mean, my memories of childhood are that there was always chores to do. It seemed like there's never a moment that you could just do nothing. And that's the legacy, I think, of my generation, is one of extremely hard physical work, taking care of animals, taking care of a garden, taking care of, you know, the younger children. So, and if we were fortunate, we did get some time to hear some stories and so forth.
That's the reality,
yeah.
Not this mythical thing sitting around absorbing the history, the culture at the foot of my parents. No, remember the hard work. Now, Marilyn grew up in that Elba Woods area, which was flooded by the Garrison Dam. And let's take just a couple of minutes to share some of those memories of that part of the reservation now that's really underwater, your homeland underwater.
Yes, well, the valley, to get into Elba Woods, you had to come either down Four Bears Hill or Good Bear Hill or the Grinnell Hill. So you would come down from the higher land into the, and it was, in fact, very beautiful valley. It was the Missouri River, made its turn there. That's why it was called Elba Woods. It was heavily wooded on one side and then buttes on the other side. Very beautiful area and very conducive to cattle ranching and gardening and farming. So that's where I was born and raised until I was 17. And I left there. I was in the last graduating class from Elba Woods. And so I know very well, you know, the sports teams, the records, academic records. I mean, everybody did well there, the students. There was a high value on education while we were in the Elba Woods area. And we talked a little bit about the Elba Woods Warriors. I was privileged to be able to see a lot of the basketball teams in action, as well as football. But basketball was our sport.
Marilyn Hudson in a 2012 conversation with Merrill Pepcorn. Marilyn Hudson was 84 years old. Coming up on Main Street, a Natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura, and Ashley Thornburg talks with a Minot entrepreneur about making bread. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The executive director of the FM Diversion Board says a fund that will grow to $75 million for cities, landowners, and businesses south of Fargo-Moorhead will be handled by the Richland-Wilkin County Joint Powers Authority. Joel Paulson helped settle the dispute, which led to lawsuits and a delay in permits for the long-sought flood control project.
A portion of our sales tax that we collect in Cass County and Fargo comes from Richland residents that come here to buy their goods, attend medical, services. And, some of that is we're giving that back to the Richland County folks. It's the JPA that distributes these funds at the local level, and they're best positioned to be able to do that and deal with the issues.
Richland County Commissioner Nathan Burseth says the agreement will provide money to several cities in the county for housing development, which has seen its population drop by about 2,000 people over the past 20 years. Georgetown, Comstock, and Wolverton, Minnesota will also benefit. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney, who chairs the Diversion Authority, calls the settlement monumental. A 46-year-old man faces numerous charges after holding law enforcement at bay for nearly 5 hours overnight at a rural Grand Forks County home. The Grand Forks Sheriff's Department was called to 1747 23rd Avenue Northeast around 10:30 p.m. last night after the residents returned home to find a man standing inside. The department's Captain Joel Lloyd says deputies attempted to make contact with the suspect, Chad Oslin of Grand Forks, without success.
This took place over the course of several hours, and deputies and negotiators continually tried to make contact with him, and he refused to respond to that contact.
Lloyd says there appears to be a connection between Oslin and at least one of the residents in the home.
It appears that he did know at least the female occupant of the residence of that house, and it appears they may have had a previous relationship.
Lloyd says the Grand Forks Special Operations Group was called out to assist in the negotiations.
During the incident, it became known that there was weapons accessible to the suspect, and our officers did deploy flashbangs and gas into the residence.
Just before 4:30 a.m., Oslin was observed climbing out of a basement window in an attempt to flee into a wooded area. He was apprehended and charged with burglary and refusal to halt. And the Red Cross is looking for volunteers.
It has been a disaster season like we have never seen before.
Gretchen Jelmstead is the executive director of the Red Cross chapter serving eastern North Dakota and northwest Minnesota. She says wildfires in the western U.S. continue to burn and the Gulf region has suffered back-to-back hurricanes. And a number of volunteers have been involved in those regions.
We'll be continuing these disaster operations for quite some time. And as you can imagine, our workforce is a little bit tired.
Jemstead says the call has gone out for volunteers not only for those disaster areas, but for local needs, such as responding to fires. She says since September 1st, the Red Cross has had 200 volunteers from the region deploy in person or virtually to those areas. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by BNC National Bank, committed to building vibrant neighborhoods through support of civic organizations, arts and cultural programming, and youth activities. Learn more at bncbank.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura used to teach college biology. He remains a naturalist with a keen interest in the plants and animals unique to our part of the world. He writes and voices our Natural North Dakota essays, and today's essay takes a close look at how some insects and plants collaborate.
I've been noticing some galls on some plants as I travel about this fall. Most of what has caught my attention has been on willows and goldenrods. I would suspect that many of you have seen what looks like small, tightly closed pine cones on some willows. Those are willow pine cone galls. They're caused by a midge, which is a mosquito-like insect. The females lay a single egg on the stem or leaf of a willow near the tip of a twig. Upon hatching, the larva crawls to the bud at the tip of the twig and burrows into it. The gall then forms from overlapping leaves, thus protecting the larva. The larva then pupates in the gall and emerges as an adult the following spring. If you're careful, you can peel apart the gall and perhaps find the larva inside. I've also been noticing some galls on Canada goldenrod. Two kinds of galls may be observed on the stems of goldenrods now throughout the winter months. The one I've been seeing most frequently is a round gall, about an inch in diameter, on the upper portion of the stem. It's caused by a fly, which has laid an egg in the stem of the goldenrod plant. Similarly, a spindle-shaped gall, or football-shaped gall, if you relate to that better, may also be observed on goldenrods. This gall's called by a moth, and like the willow pinecone gall, if one's careful, the larva may be observed inside. This gall, however, is much tougher to open. So just what is a gall? It might surprise you, but gall formation is a defense mechanism in response to isolate an insect or pathogen from the rest of the plant. Gall formation is often initiated when an insect oviposits an egg or eggs inside the tissue of the host plant. The gall itself may be composed of plant tissue, but the insect apparently controls the form. The characteristic of the gall is unique to the insect species. The female injects some chemical or chemicals into the plant, which stimulates gall formation, and when the larva develops, it may also continue to produce the substances. In some cases, sugars even accumulate in the gall in response to enzymes produced by the insect, assumedly to ensure energy. So be on the lookout for galls as you travel about. There are some interesting ecological, physiological, and evolutionary factors at work here. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Yesterday on our show, Ashley Thornburg talked about her weekend visit to Minot to appear in the local comedy show Goodnight Live. While she was in the Magic City, she also talked with folks about adjusting to a pandemic. For example, Prairie Sky Breads opened its doors in Minot earlier this year, only to close a week later following COVID-19 protocols. Ashley visited with co-owner Jasmine Schultz about how the business is coping and making bread during the pandemic.
Jasmine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
February 2020 turned out to be quite a month to open a business.
It was an interesting time to open a business, that's for sure.
Obviously, COVID was happening right at the beginning of your brick-and-mortar story.
Yes.
But I understand that your story as Prairie Sky goes back a little bit.
It does, yeah. So Travis, the other owner, started this as a farmer's market stand about 5 years ago. Just helping another person. He had moved here. He was trying to meet people. He was helping with their farmer's market stand, and they invited him to maybe make some stuff, make some bread, and he did that. And then slowly but surely, he kind of gathered a following, and he just continued from there. And so has been borrowing kitchens around town and doing that for the past 4 years. And then finally, when he decided to go into making a bakery, then he contacted my husband and I.
Because you're friends or because you're also bakers?
Bandmates and sort of community organizers in the community, and he had a real heart for wanting to make this a community hub, and so sort of involved us to run the front of house activities, and at the time we were going to do music events, and it was going to be all sorts of community involvement, event planning inside of the bakery, which obviously has been, we've done a little bit, but not as much as we had planned in the beginning. So, yeah, we run the front of the house, and I had some coffee barista knowledge from my college days. And
sure.
So just kind of used all of those things to, yeah.
And you say Travis was kind of invited into making this bread. Does that mean that he didn't have training in cooking and baking?
So he has no formal training. He's done a few classes and things like that now, and has been fortunate to jump over the border and go to a couple other bakeries and learn from them. But a lot of it was just time spent with his grandma making her bread recipes and trying to perfect them. And then lots of reading and, yeah, DIY, intuitiveness. Yeah. To start this.
Good bread is an art and a science.
Yes. We don't serve the same things every week. And I always tease it. It's like, well, this is an art, right? This is Travis's art. And so, you know, he doesn't want to make the same things all the time, every week. And so we try to help further his like artistic ambitions through through the business as well. But yeah, certainly he's got the kind of personality too that really lends itself well to this sort of thing too. I'm big picture and he can do all the fine details.
In what ways is being in a band just like baking bread?
I feel like perhaps, and maybe not always, you need to have kind of be on the same page about what your message is going to be and mm-hmm. how you're going to do things. And the great news for us is that we're sort of on the same page with how we intend to run the business and want to run the business. And a lot of that, I think, has come from our DIY organizing. And weirdly, I feel like that running a bakery can be a lot like being in a band. And then there's just like the artistic part of it too. I guess our passion for infusing the bakery world with a little bit of the community and the art aspect that we've always been involved in. And so, I don't know, it's oddly applicable.
What would you say, if you can sum it up, is the role of a local business to the heart of a community?
There are a lot of ways in which you can assist that you might not be aware of initially, but I think if, particularly if you're looking to be a community-minded business, the opportunities will present themselves, and you can go out of your way to be excited about them and offer space to them and perhaps use your day-old goods to be utilized at a food pantry. There's just a lot of different ways to be a community hub and to be a part of downtown and all that's happening if you're open to accepting the opportunity to do that.
Community building during COVID
is
a little different.
Very.
How does Prairie Sky Breads approach that balance of safety and being open to the community and making a living?
Yeah, it's very challenging. And basically what we've decided to do is just to do what makes us feel most confident. Our caution is perhaps more than other businesses have chose to do, but that's just because that's what we need to do to sleep at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Event planning and community organizing amongst all this has gotten a little bit hairy, but we've tried to pioneer some new things, got involved in a couple fundraisers with some local organizations to do concerts in the bakery where we just have a video and we're streaming the event. We've done some artist boxes where we hired local artists to put together the boxes so that people could do sort of a crafty, fun, artsy activity with their kids and pair it maybe with a scone. You could just pick it all up curbside at the bakery and then take it home and do that activity. In that way, I guess we're able to support artists and we're also able to give people something to do that maybe is a little bit outside of their wheelhouse. I don't know. There's just been a lot of strange opportunities that have been really awesome for us. And it's difficult because I come from a very, like, how many people can I pack into a building?
Mm-hmm. Without breaking fire code.
Yeah, a certain element of, like, the people element that's really important to the work that I've done over the past 10 years. So trying to still cultivate a feeling of, like, we're in this, we're doing this together, and the magic that happens at, like, a show or a community event, trying to still create that with distance is hard. And definitely has put me outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah, I heard one friend say, I'm not social distancing, I'm distantly socializing.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's very nice.
Is it helpful, do you think, to have been so new at this at the time of COVID because you don't have habits that you have to break? You can pivot more easily?
Certainly. When we went to full curbside, we had to flip our business model in like a week, and we'd never intended on,
How long had you been open?
We had been open. We'd done some like soft launches and things like that, probably about 3 weeks or four weeks. And then, I mean, we had some stuff in place. We had website and things that had been used for subscribers, people who got a loaf of bread every week that needed to be turned into like a full-blown store. But what I always say is the first day after we did that, I hated it so much that I would have never persevered. I never would have continued doing it because we were trying to answer the phone and we were trying to get online orders and in-store like orders, and we were trying to run everything all at the same time, that it was too much for me. That had I been given a choice, I don't know how quickly I would have ever returned to doing curbside on top of everything else that okay. needs to happen in a bakery every day. So in a lot of ways, it pushed me to persevere and continue with it, even mm-hmm. though it just was a lot at the time. So okay. I think it was good in a lot of ways. And now I sort of feel like it's like, not that I want to jinx it, but like, I sort of wonder, like, what could possibly be thrown at us that it, like, would feel as big as this.
Don't tempt the universe.
I know.
Don't do it.
2020, but in a lot of ways, it feels like, well, if we can do it and, you know, make enough money to exist and follow all of our morals and all of those things in the time of COVID, I just can't help but think that it might be easier. I can just stick with the business model. We are literally ebbing and flowing every single week. So I just can't help but think that it might be easier once we are in a consistent pattern.
You just said follow our morals. And earlier you said you adopted business practices that allowed you to sleep at night.
Yeah.
How do you describe your personal ethics?
What's fun about this business is that it's ours. And so we can make choices that perhaps are not common choices. And see if they work. And so I've always felt like doing things like paying people other than server wages, adopting business practices that are maybe less common, maybe would affect a bottom line, mask mandates, things like that. I felt like it was possible. I like to think that we're walking the walk.
We're visiting with Jasmine Schultz. She is the co-owner of Prairie Sky Breads, which just opened its brick-and-mortar store right before COVID hit. And Jasmine, like we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, it was a subscription service, farmers market business that grew into the brick-and-mortar. And obviously, there is some personal savings and getting financial support and loans and whatnot going into that. But there also had to have been community support.
Certainly. And I think that has been a real boon to us during this time of COVID as well, is that there was a base of subscribers and supporters that were really, really adamant about supporting us during that time too and going out of their way to do that. And so, yeah, there was that community support. There was a Kickstarter campaign that kicked off a lot of the funding for the bakery and allowed us to buy some of our big mixers and the things that we needed to initially get the operation off the ground. We call them bread fans. They're rabid and awesome and great and truly supportive and have been really important part of growing this as well.
So how much do you know about what makes bread special?
It's a painstaking attention to detail art, but it also doesn't come without a lot of love and compassion and care. That's what makes bread too, you know, is all of that. And fortunately, we're also, you know, able to invite people in still. And all of that makes for great bread and great community and all the things that we're hopefully going to be able to continue to do here in 2020.
And as you said, love and compassion, you really leaned in and actually moved your hands as if you were kneading bread and infusing this bread while we're talking about it.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you do any of the food prep?
I typically do not. So okay. I do a lot of the cold brew straining and that activities. And our website and all of the components of running the curbside and the delivery and the marketing and all of those things are sort of more my wheelhouse. Occasionally I'll get into the kitchen and I made some dog treats this week for a fundraiser. You know, there are some things that I do get involved in the kitchen as well.
How does Prairie Sky Breads plan a menu?
We change the menu weekly, which is a little bit insane, but it makes for fun and different experience every time you come. Typically, there's like a base menu of things that you can find every week. Then Stephanie, our kitchen manager, comes in with her ideas of things that she would like to create. So usually it's like a new soup and a new sandwich. My husband does the pizza, and so he comes up with the pizza special and the thing that we're going to try and do that week for that. And then Travis comes in with all of his ideas for what breads he wants to make and feels inspired to make that week. And then that's what we have. And then I update the website and tell everyone what we have and tell them on Facebook and Instagram and all of those things. So
nice.
Yeah.
Did you guys run into the, you know, everybody started hoarding yeast and flour and everything at the beginning of COVID and just decided all of a sudden they're artisan bread bakers.
This is like a real pivotal moment where we could not find cream in this town. And I was like beside myself trying to hunt cream down so that we can make the scones that we make. So we did run into some of those things. More oddly, like paper packaging has been very difficult to find. Mm. Yeah, there's just been a lot of weird things. People were calling us for yeast, you know, help with sourdough and things like that. So we tried to help where we could, but there was some definite shortage of items, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, and I noticed too that the food, in an effort to limit the spread of COVID, you're not doing food on the traditional ceramic or porcelain or whatever dishes are made out of that you would wash.
Yeah.
And they are being served in packages. I'm feeling like it's okay to assume that you definitely decided no styrofoam.
Yeah, we did. Our intention was actually talking about the kind of the beginning of when we started. We had three holes in the garbage. We were going to try to recycle and actually try compost and mine out, which is new territory. We eventually were going to do that, but the least we can do right now is to keep our staff safe. And so what we're trying to do is to limit their exposure. And so at the moment, we are choosing to use paper products, but we tried to choose ones that were the least harmful as possible.
What kind of music do you play?
I'm in a rock and roll band. I play bass and sing. It's, I don't know, they call it power pop. That's what the kids are telling me it is. I don't really know.
Oh, I'm too old to know what
that is. Yeah, I know. I'm in my 30s now, still playing rock and roll. But so it's, I guess, popular rock and roll. And then I'm in a folk band with Travis. Remember, Floats My Boat. As if our business isn't, like, really indicative of that, too. We're like, whatever makes us excited artistically. That's what we do.
Do you know what's next?
I get really excited about community projects. And I guess right now I have some real excitement around community art and trying to do perhaps some things in the community together to still participate in music. And so I have my brain, I'm kind of simmering on a couple different ideas, so maybe like a snowy art gallery sort of situation, maybe in the back alley where we all like pop up and make some snow sculptures overnight, and then we have some hot chocolate.
And we're all going to be wearing scarves as masks anyway.
Yeah, we'll be outside. Yeah, and some maybe different platforms of releasing music, too. We have an album that we haven't released yet, so just trying to think about different ways we could do that. So I really don't know what's ahead, and perhaps I'm a little bit more comfortable than a lot of people in that space. I get excited about not knowing what I'm going to do next, and so I'm okay. Things are okay.
Jasmine, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for coming, and thanks for spending time in Minot.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Prairie Sky Bread's co-owner Jasmine Schultz. This week we'll feature conversations from Minot during our show. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well. On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
critics have called the Choice 2020 smart as ever. And never more important. Explore the Frontline Transparency Project.
I think my dad would have done that differently.
Where you can dig into the complete interviews
exactly
from the choice.
Right. And Joe is always able to say, yeah, I didn't handle that quite right.
Fair, trusted, and transparent. The Choice 2020.
Watch Frontline The Choice 2020 tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 27th. The railroad was an improvement over wagon trains, but early travelers across the Great Plains still did not have it easy. Trains were slower than we might imagine, averaging just 25 miles per hour. Trains could go faster on the straightaways, but had to slow for sharp curves, bridges, tunnels, and wildlife. The cars were hot in the summer and cold in the winter. Passengers had to bring their own food and endure uncomfortable seats. While most passengers had to suffer, there was a class who traveled in style and comfort. One such passenger was Jerome Marble. On this date, in 1877, a dispatch from the Bismarck Tribune reported that the wealthy Massachusetts businessman and his hunting party had arrived in Marble's Palace on Wheels. Marble and his friends rode the rails in comfort unknown to most frontier travelers. According to the Bismarck Tribune, Marble's private car was considered a rare piece of workmanship. The Salt Lake Herald called it the finest excursion car ever built. The car achieved a fame all its own and came to be known as the Jerome Marble. The 24-foot car boasted velvet carpet, comfortable rocking chairs, brocade curtains, and an upright piano. At night, heavy curtains separated the car into bedrooms. There was a compact kitchen with an icebox. A second car carried his four dogs, hunting equipment, his chef, and his staff. Marble parked the car on a siding and used it as a hotel. When ready to move on, he had the car added to a passing train for transport to his next destination. The gentlemen spent their days hunting. They took a massive number of ducks, geese, prairie chickens, rabbits, coyotes, antelope, deer, and foxes. On one trip, they reported killing 1,500 prairie chickens. The ladies generally remained with the car while the men hunted. One newspaper reported that the ladies amused themselves as in any well-regulated mansion. Marble and his famous car continued to turn up in the news. Each summer, he and his party spent several months traveling the West. In 1892, the Bismarck Tribune reported on Marble's 22nd annual hunting trip. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We're almost to the last day of voting, and anxiety is high. So is distrust and suspicion. Experts warn the conditions could lead to conflict, maybe violence.
We are at the edge of an abyss, and we better see this and try to step back before it is too late.
Preparing for the potential of election chaos on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, a good idea for a business or community project is just the first step. The Minot-based nonprofit Strengthen North Dakota offers help from writing grants to identifying who benefits. On our show tomorrow, we'll learn more from Executive Director Megan Laudenschlager. And Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter will talk with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy about his new book, which examines America's history of gun violence. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.